this is Hard Place, a novel by R.A. Jacobson. Listener discretion is advised, contains strong language, violence, and some adult situations. Chapter 3. Matt Wakes Looking the Wrong Way. If you don't have any answers and the questions keep adding up, you have to take a moment and decide if you're facing the right direction. Matt could hear Alan's words in his head. He had said it several times in the months Matt had been working with him. It hadn't made any sense to Matt. Now, however, he was starting to get the feeling he was facing the wrong direction.
"Coffee," Matt said to the dark.
He threw back the covers and sat on the edge of the bed, the dream fading as his brain realized he was awake.
Wrong direction?
He rose and went to the bathroom, then to the kitchen for coffee. After a couple of minutes of opening cupboards, the truth was inescapable. He was out of coffee. He heard a noise in the bedroom.
Fuck. What is her name? Sherry? Cheryl? Sharon. Yes, Sharon.
He walked back and pulled on his jeans. From the bed, a sleepy voice said, "What are you doing?"
"I'm going out to get coffee," he said, putting on his t-shirt.
Matt glanced at his watch. 8:40. Matt thought about it for a minute. He actually hadn't planned to come back. He wanted her gone.
"I'll be a half an hour, probably," he said, hoping it would be too long.
Shit, okay, I have to go. Sharon pushed the covers down, resigned. She was stunning, sleep warm and naked. Her dark hair was a tangled mess over her face and pillow. Briefly, he thought, coffee could wait. Then she swore again and sat up and started getting dressed. She pushed her hair back into place with her fingers and with a smile said, "This was nice." She kissed him as she passed on her way to the bathroom. She did not close the door. She wasn't shy. When she came back in the bedroom, he was lacing up his runners.
"Have you seen my purse?" she asked.
Yeah, it's over there under your jacket." He pointed at a chair in the corner of the room. She walked over and put her coat on, picked up her purse, and kissed him again. "Bye." She turned and left the room. A second later, he heard the apartment door close. With a shrug, he left to get coffee. He should have gotten her number. Matt was a tall man with unruly hair and a long, easy stride that covered distance quickly. He wore a gray trench coat he had purchased a few months ago when he had got the job as private eye. Even now, tired and worried, he still loved the sound of it. Private eye. After he graduated from police college, the depot, he had found work. The first month on the job had been horrid. General duty was not what he had expected. He realized what he wanted to be was an investigator, but the way the system was structured, it would take years before he could be, if ever. A friend of his father had said he knew a guy who was looking for a junior partner in a detective agency. So Matt got the number and called. Alan Cole seemed to be a nice enough fellow. When Matt spoke to him on the phone, he stressed he wasn't in a hurry to hire someone. They talked for a bit and set a meeting for later in the week. On the appointed day, Matt made sure to show up early. As they talked, Alan seemed to take a liking to him and offered him the job. Matt didn't hesitate. He took the offer. The pay wasn't great, and it was contingent on the number of cases he cleared, but there were bonuses. A week into the job, he bought a trench coat. When he came back to the office wearing it, Alan had nearly fallen over laughing. He didn't say anything, though. He shook his head and walked back to his desk. Every few minutes, Matt could hear Alan chuckle. He felt embarrassed, although he wasn't sure why. He loved the coat. He could imagine himself as Sam Spade, a real PI. And that thought made him smile. Alan mentioned his last partner a lot. Matt figured Alan was still in a bit of shock over what had happened. He had never told Matt many of the details, but from what he had said, his death sounded pretty bizarre. As he walked down the street anticipating coffee, he thought about his dream and about Alan. He hadn't heard from him for a couple of days and was getting a bit concerned. He had to admit he really didn't know Alan very well, but this seemed to be out of character. Alan struck him as a very reliable kind of guy, not one who would vanish for days. There was a small coffee shop called A Scratch in Time, not far from his apartment. It was on a back street lined with large overhanging trees and had just enough old-timey quirkiness without becoming kitsch. If he was lucky, he could grab one of the comfy chairs by the window and watch people walk by. It would be nice to spend an hour or so to think. He walked into the cafe and was disappointed. There was a couple sitting by the window. He was standing at the front counter, ready to order his coffee, when his phone rang. Matt was surprised and relieved to see it was Alan. He held up his finger to the kid working behind the counter, who scowled. He turned and walked away, letting the man behind him move forward and order. "Alan, where have you been?" he said. He waited. He knew there was somebody on the other line, but they were quiet. "Alan?" he said. "Matt! That's weird! I was just thinking about you!" The voice on the other end was Alan's, but it sounded wrong, confused, and fuzzy. "Fuck, it burns!" The line went dead. Matt called Alan back. It rang several times, then went to voicemail. He hung up and dialed again, with the same result. He stared at his phone for a minute, hoping it would ring, but it didn't. Frustrated, he shoved it into his pocket and looked out to the street. The weirdness of it all was maddening. A small voice in his head thought maybe this was some sort of test, put the new guy through the ringer. But if he was honest with himself, it didn't feel fake. It felt weird for sure, but real. Something was definitely wrong. He returned to the kid and ordered his coffee. It arrived as the couple in the window vacated the chairs. He rushed over and sat. An hour later, he was still there with his third cup. He was new to the investigator role, but with his boss missing, it was time to put what he had learned and his instincts to the test. He had spent some time on his phone looking into what he could find out about Alan, which wasn't much beyond what he already knew. But he did find some things about Alan's former partner. He reviewed what he knew and what he had gleaned. Phil had been a longtime friend of Alan's. Each had been in law enforcement, and each had aspired for more. They had started the agency together, a partnership lasting over 12 years. Several months ago, Phil committed suicide after some sort of episode. The details were sketchy. Matt relinquished his treasured spot by the window to a young couple. He glanced out the window to the street and realized he hadn't actually sat and people-watched as he'd planned. He'd been on his phone the whole time. What a waste. The office he shared with Alan was several blocks south of his apartment, closer to downtown. It was within walking distance, however he rarely walked. He had a beaten-down old 2001 Volkswagen Beetle. So not a real Beetle, but as close as he was likely to get to one. It was silver with a large dent on the passenger side door. A leak in the muffler made it loud, and it stunk of exhaust. Windows open, he rumbled down the street looking for a parking spot. The office building was a four-story cube of brick plunked down in the middle of what had been a residential street, looking very out of place. Surrounding it were three-story Victorians, mostly offices of various kinds. Some rental apartments were mixed in with the lawyers, dental offices, and even a psychic. Matt wedged his VW between a long black car and a red sedan. One of the things he liked about the bug, it was very easy to park. He walked up the street to the cement steps in front of the building and paused. In his head, Matt heard Alan's voice. "Watch for a tickling in the back of your mind." It was a weird little phrase Alan was fond of saying. Matt looked back down the street where he'd parked his car. Something was tickling his brain. Further down, where the street turned, stood a tall, thin man wearing a dark suit and a large brimmed hat. Everything about him felt out of place. Matt watched as he was joined by another nearly identical man. The two men were watching him with big, toothy grins splitting their faces. After a minute, they looked at each other, then in unison turned and disappeared around the corner. Matt stared at the spot where they had vanished from sight. "They're here," he said to the empty street, and with a shrug entered the building, smiling at his private joke. Matt spent the next hour at his desk, searching for anything he could find on Phil and Alan. He knew what he had to do and was procrastinating. Resigned, he crossed to Alan's office and sat in his chair. He flipped through papers stacked in loose piles, rummaged through drawers, all the while feeling like a little kid about to get caught snooping. After a few minutes, he got up and went to the front desk. They didn't have a receptionist, perhaps in their busier days, but not since Matt had started. He combed through planners and folders, even booted up the vintage computer, searching for any clues that might explain Alan's absence. He found nothing. He went back to Alan's office, and without sitting, he resumed digging through the stacks of papers. Most were case files, active or recently closed. There was nothing to suggest a holiday or a business trip Alan had forgotten to tell Matt about. The office phone rang. Matt picked the one up on Alan's desk.
ACPM investigation. Matt speaking. How can I help you? He said as businessy as he could.
The line was staticky and weirdly hollow-sounding. Not a digital distortion, a sound almost like a wind howling, and in there, somewhere, was a voice far off and faint. He was sure there were voices speaking, but as he concentrated, trying to pick out words, the line went dead. Matt looked at the receiver and hung up the phone and sat. This is getting him nowhere. He knew no more than he had at the coffee shop. He leaned back on his chair, laced his fingers behind his head. There was nothing here. He could worry all day about Alan, but it wasn't getting any work done. If Alan was just taking a few days off, when he returned, Matt had better been working, or there would be hell to pay.
Chapter 4. John Whitey Burnett. Let me tell you about John Whitey Burnett. When John played, men like John Hurt, Sunhouse, and even Robert Johnson listened and were in awe. He pulled from his guitar fragrances of the bayou, the delta, the dusty roads, places he'd been, songs which had come drifting in on the air through cracked, smudged windows of various homes and shacks he'd lived in, women he'd known, memories of odd jobs and fractured moments, light from stars, sunsets, and lovers' eyes. It wouldn't be long till the world knew his name. More importantly, they would know his songs, his music. He would send lovers into a thrall with only one possible end, cause old men to weep for all that had been lost to them, and he would make the devil cry. The devil, in the back, would smile, and then he would cry a single tear. One tear would be enough, enough to drown all Whitey's sorrows, all his doubts, with time, it was, after all, only a song away.
Chapter 5. Jacob thinks Whitey is stupid. Jacob's headlight pushed at the dark as he tore down the highway. It was a bubble of light he chased, a cocoon in the dark. White lines flashed past, blurring through his headlight wash as he pulled on the throttle. The air was cold on his cheeks. He crouched, getting closer to the heat coming off his knucklehead. He squinted into the wind, remembering Billy, remembering his friend. Flashes of Billy's eyes staring at him, the sad-skinned dog, Billy's hideous grin, and his tiny, bloody body, his sexless body. He pulled off the blacktop, back wheel skidding into the Old Scratch Tavern gravel parking lot. The neon sign coated the lot with a dark red laced with uncertain shadows. Jacob revved the knucklehead once and shut the bike off. He became keenly aware of the quiet. He sat, relishing the novel silence, then leaned the bike on its stand. The bike ticked as it cooled. The lot was nearly empty. A couple of beat-up old trucks, and off in the shadows, a long, dark car lurked. The four-door Lincoln was an unusual sight. Normally, he would have walked over and taken a closer look at the suicide-doored beauty, but not tonight. The building was squat and ugly, tarted up to look like an old-time saloon, sheeted with weathered barn board, wagon wheels, and a couple of fake cow skulls. Above the bar, a neon sign buzzed. A devil, complete with horns, a pitchfork, and a pointy tail, threatened a bikini-clad woman with Old Scratch Tavern spelled out beneath the tableau. Frank, the owner, was very proud of this sign, and he should be. He had paid enough for it.
Jacob's boots crunched on the gravel as he approached the tavern. A semi screamed past on the highway behind him as he pulled the metal door open and stepped into the overheated, beer-laden air. He walked to the long bar running down one side of the narrow room. A few working men sat holding well-earned pints at high-top tables on the opposite side. Far off in the corner, a couple of bikers from the jurors racked for a game of pool. Jacob nodded to them when they looked up. Where the bar ended, the room turned left and opened into a larger room with a small stage at the end. Occasionally, Frank had live music. He parked himself on a red leather stool. Brandy pulled him a pint and smiled as she placed it on a devil's face coaster in front of him. "Just a second," she said, and moved to pull another pint. He growled quietly. Outwardly, Jacob hated being called Hun. He wouldn't admit it, but it made him feel special somehow. Brandy walked down to the bar to drop off a pint in front of an old farmer who looked like he was settling in for the night. She walked back to Jacob, seemingly unaware of the eyes on her. "So his deal's done," Brandy leaned forward on the bar. "Wait, Billy was marked? He had a deal?" Jacob paused, the pint halfway to his lips. "You didn't know?" Brandy looked surprised. "You and Billy were close." "Yeah, I guess I just never noticed, and Clyde never said." Jacob looked down at his beer. Brandy shrugged. "Actually, I'm not surprised. Billy saw what happened to you and wanted no part of it. He was pissed when his brother made his deal. Thought he was an idiot, but then he got to thinking and thought he was so clever. He met with the judge and sold to be lucky."
"Lucky?" Jacob looked up.
"Yeah. He figured it was a safe deal. Of course, he didn't think of balance. Every time he got lucky, somebody he loved got unlucky. He won a toaster at bingo and his brother's arm got burnt at the diner. Shit like that."
"That's why he's got all those TVs and shit in the garage."
"Yeah, he figured pretty fast what happened if he won something big. Remember, he won all that money at the dealership lottery and then his sister died in that car crash."
"Yeah, I remember." Jacob took a swallow of his pint. "Well, he ain't lucky anymore."
Brandy held up a finger, pulled another pint, and walked over to the old farmer. Jacob drank his beer, looking at his reflection in the mirror behind the racks of bottles. A spot of red caught his eye. At first, he thought it was a reflection of the neon from the outside or from one of the bottles, but it grew. He realized it was not the same red, and he knew what was happening. The red revealed a woman walking toward him, chin lowered, naked and pale, with bright red hair. He glanced behind him, knowing as he did, there was no naked red-headed woman. He turned back, inwardly smiling at his foolishness. He watched her easy sway and soft, fleshy movements, a subtle ballet. Her hand came up, and with half-lidded eyes, she beckoned. Jacob finished his beer as Brandy returned.
"Not sure what's going on. Don't make sense that the skins are back. Have you heard anything?"
A quick glance at the mirror confirmed the redhead was no longer there.
"No, it's been quiet," Brandy said.
"I think I'll go down to Franklin's slough. See if Red has any thoughts."
Brandy rocked back on a hip. "Really, just for answers, not for anything else."
Jacob grinned.
"Well, shit. Don't let her sisters catch you.
You'll be in some deep shit then."
"Wait, did she do that fucking mirror thing?"
Jacob's grin widened.
"Well, fuck. It always feels like it can't get the fucking mirror clean after."
"Who's the guy on stage?"
"Whitey something claims he sold his soul to the devil for 12 songs.
"Well, that's a stupid deal." Jacob slid off the stool.
"You sold yours for a truck, talking about stupid."
"Yeah, well, I guess they're all kind of stupid."
Outside, the night hadn't warmed up any. Jacob kicked his bike to life. The bike growled, scattering gravel, and the back tire protested as he pulled out onto the blacktop. 20 minutes later, he pulled off the road, bounced across the frozen earth on a dormant field, and shut the bike off. It was very dark without the bike's headlight. In the distance, he could see a yard light of the Petersons' farm. His eyes adjusted. To the south, past the horizon, he could see the glow of the far-off city. He was cold.
even as Knucklehead hadn't warned him, maybe because he anticipated what he would have to do next. Jacob walked down the ditch to the willows to stand at the edge of the black, glassy water. The song of a red-winged blackbird greeted him. It was the sound of home, a greeting, and something else. He scowled, not looking forward to what he had to do. He was already cold, standing at the edge of the slough with his leathers on. The song came again. He smiled, a hard thing without real joy. He pulled off his jacket, then, reluctantly, the rest of his clothes. Squeezed himself, his skin bone white and already shivering, as he stepped forward to the water's edge. The muck that slipped between his toes somehow felt warmer than the water that rose to his thighs. He chuckled at a joke his gran used to tell and realized how inappropriate it was. Shrinkage would be the enemy, especially if he wanted to get some answers. That's why he was here, after all. He smiled at his lie. True, he would get answers, wrapped in a riddle that would infuriate him for days. He also knew the more pressing reason he had willingly gone to the slough on a chilly night. A flash of brilliant red and a blackbird blurring, morphing, as it landed on a small tuft of dry brown grass and mud a short distance from him. A confusing vibration in the air, and she was there. She was a woman best described as full. Full lips, full breasts, full hair, shocking red hair. She stood there, pale, starkly white, silhouetted against the dark gray-green of the surroundings. She was waiting. He pushed forward, the water now at his waist, keenly aware of the frigid line that crept up his skin with each step he took. Suppressing a shudder, he gritted his teeth. The cold was everywhere, inescapable, all-encompassing. It was quickly becoming dominant in his mind. He worked at pushing it aside, dripping wet, shivering almost uncontrollably, he stepped up onto the relative dryness of the mound where she stood. He towered above her. "Nice to see you, Jacob. I've been thinking about you." Red's smile had an edge he was unsure of. "Yeah, I saw. I'm always impressed by the mirror trick." She tipped her head, an oddly animal movement. He thought of the way dogs tilt their heads quizzically. He was reminded of the distance between them. She wasn't completely human, despite her appearance, so her motivations were not necessarily the same. She moved forward and embraced him. He groaned with relief. She was all heat, all warmth. She was all softness, and all thoughts vanished, cold into warmth. They lay on the grass-covered mound, surrounded by cold, dark water. Distantly, he could feel the cold, muddy ground beneath him. He slipped into her like a man falling into quicksand, engulfed in her world. He lost himself in the fullness, heat, hands, breasts, hardness, softness, lips saying so much without breath, and sighs carried volumes. Minutes passed, hours, days, months, forever passed. She was on top, her back arched impossibly. The air became alive with a flurry of beating wings. Her head flew back and she screamed. "One man will burn. One will be betrayed. Everything you place in the ground will rise. Four will come seeking. They will not like what you have to say. The ants have a question you cannot answer. The truth that seems so clear will be wrong. Two words will change your life. Your guilt will be lifted. Two faces revealed. One false, one holds power. When silver is scattered on pavement." She collapsed on him. Minutes, hours, days passed, and the cold returned, seeping up into him from the wet ground. She lay, her red hair fell about, half covering him. "Did you hear what you wanted?" she said, her voice syrup thick, lazy and deep.
"Not sure. As usual, it takes a while for me to figure out what you said."
"Why can't you just talk plain?" He felt the mud beneath him, cold and slippery. She squirmed closer to him. "Doesn't work that way. I don't actually know what I said, just the feelings behind the words." "Don't go see the judge. And if you do, not without Clyde. There's something going on. The air feels different."
Jacob grunted and moved, regretting the loss of her heat. She moved as well, reluctantly. Casting an apologetic smile, he stepped back into the water, turned and walked to the opposite shore. He pulled his clothes on. They stuck to his skin, blue and cold. He glanced back. She was standing, naked and pale, in the dark, frigid slough. The sight of her made him feel colder. He shivered, turned away, and swung his leg over his bike. As the growl of the bike receded, four blackbirds landed behind Red, becoming women as they touched the mud.
"Will he go see the judge?" the sisters asked.
She watched the horizon, though she could not see him right away. "Yes, he will. But I think he'll go to the ants first. His hatred still blinds him. He doesn't suspect yet." As he rode, Jacob bent low, hugging the knucklehead, shivering. The wind made it worse. He slowed, then stopped by the side of the road. Nothing was making sense. "Skins are back, or at least two are. Were," he corrected himself. "Clyde's not talking. Probably pissed because he left him in the garage all this time. It's been a long while since he could face the world through his windshield. Clyde would be there, would always be with him, until he died and fulfilled his contract. Over the years, he had become more resentful of the truck, maybe because it had been quiet, and the two worlds hadn't looked different. Clyde was always in his head, reminding him of his stupidity, his youth. Looking into the dark, he thought of Mary Lou, trying to imagine her his age now. He realized then where he'd stopped. This is where he had made his fatal error, his deal, and where it all had gone wrong, at the crossroads. He spat and tore back onto the road, the knucklehead growling angrily beneath him. Stories from a Hard Place is a narrative podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, R.A. Jacobson presents another chapter from Hard Place, read by the author. Opening music by Noah Zacharin. Production copyright by R.A. Jacobson, 2022. If you'd like to support Stories from a Hard Place, please go to patreon.com/hardplace. If you would like a book version, either ebook or print, you can find it anywhere books are sold, including your local library. You can find links to all these and much more at Dead Cat Studio. That's deadcatstud.io. Thanks for listening. Keep the shiny side up.